Hi, this is Colin Rowe, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. So how about tonight's music by the Eulogy Brothers? Did y'all like the Eulogy Brothers? The Eulogy Brothers consist of Brad Williams of the Salty Dogs and Isaac Alexander of Big Silver, both Little Rock mainstay bands. More can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here strumming his 1931 National Resonator is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Native Mark Simpson was, among other things, a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Eureka Springs artist Caitlin Cantell with this piece right over here entitled Chicken, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this painting and Caitlin at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our writers discover, sometimes during, sometimes after the fact, that what they just did was not such a good idea. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Deb Cantrell's mom's plan for her doesn't have the intended result. And we'll end the night with Candace Parker as she realizes in the middle of the woods that things are quickly going downhill. But let's start the night with Melanie Baden and a temptation in the Piggly Wiggly that proves to be her undoing in Lessons in Junk Food.
We were standing in line at Crystal, and I had just popped the chocolate into my mouth when my mom let out a sigh. That sounds a lot like the noise the crowd makes when there's about to be a home run at a baseball game, and then gasp because it turns out to be a foul ball. What could she possibly be so upset about? I mean, I know I ruined my dinner, but come on, it's Crystal's. My mom yanked my criminal chocolate hand and dragged me out the door and back to the Piggly Wiggly. It turns out I had single-handedly lifted the copper foil-wrapped chocolate footballs. I had stolen something for the first time in my life, and I didn't even know it. I was a 7-year-old thief. Just a half hour before that, I had stepped out of the car and pranced with my mom in the Piggly Wiggly, wearing my beautiful white rabbit fur coat and hand muffs. It was, you know, an outing slightly short of going to church. That year, my sister and I had gotten genuine white rabbit fur coats for Christmas, you know, complete with the fur earmuffs and hand muffs. We wore them everywhere and in every temperature. They made us feel, well, rich. That was the year my parents divorced. And Elvis died. And it was hard for me to tell from my mom's reaction which one was more devastating. That was also the first year my sister and I walked to school and back. My mom worked, and we were what people called latchkey kids. Latchkey kids always seem to have an imagination, and we had a big one. We figured out when we left school that if we pitched our flip-flops in the creek, by the time we reached our duplex, our flip-flops would arrive. And sure enough, there they were, riddled with green, slimy moss and creek water waiting for our bare feet. Our skateboards, banana boat bicycles, and Light Bright occupied most of our time until Mom got back from work. Meanwhile, we created our own after-school snacks as Electric Company blared in the background. We had perfected the Oreo mound. We would open a new bag of Oreos and with great intent scrape the glorious sweet white middle out of each cookie and into a green plastic bowl. Tupperware, of course. We took the hard chocolate and crumbled it like fine sand from an hourglass into another bowl. We worked it like Play-Doh, round and round in the palm of our hands. In fact, it looked like the moon, but without the flag. We rolled with great precision the white mound into the delicate grit of chocolate. The chocolate smothered the white completely. So completely, it reminded me of those styrofoam sequin ornaments we used to make. Not one sequin was allowed, and not one millimeter of the sweet whiteness showed. Chocolate covered it entirely, and it was entirely edible. And then, yes, we took giant bites with our little mouths into this perfect storm of sugar. The Oreo mound was a heavenly after-school snack. Mom glided the cart through Piggly Wiggly that day, me skipping behind, my white rabbit fur coat snuggled against me. We turned down the cleaning aisle. Each shelf, I noticed, was lined with bald and burly men. Mr. Clean and Mr. Brawny were everywhere. One bald and shining with a big veneer smile. The other, a mountain man clad in his plaid. At this point in my life, I had never seen a man clean anything. Ever. And I wondered why they seemed to appear on every cleaning product. We were loaded up and ready to check out. The grocery cart included all the trimmings of a single mom. Fish sticks, macaroni and cheese, these awesome shoestring potato thingies in a can, hamburger helper, wafer cookies, pink, yellow, and brown, Neapolitan ice cream, orange push-ups, of course, Oreos, Vienna sausages, and a box of chicken and a biscuit. We were set for at least a week. As we checked out, I spied the delightful little sparkly copper-colored footballs. I mean, they were right there at my reach. I thought, how neat. These even go with the pro football helmets I've been collecting from the quarter machines. I grabbed a few and stuck them in my fur hand muff for safekeeping. My main concern was the chocolate would melt and mess up my pretty white fur coat. We checked out, and Mom loaded all the groceries in the car. Then we walked to Crystal. As we stood in the line, waiting for our sliders and fries, I couldn't wait. I had to unwrap one of the copper footballs and enjoy the delicious chocolate now melting in my hands. That's when my mom let out the sigh, grabbed my hand, and dragged me back to the Piggly Wiggly. I was crying now, and I had no idea why. All I knew was that I didn't want anything to get on my white fur coat. I entered the Piggly Wiggly, my hand hurting, still tightly in my mom's. She asked for the manager. We walked to a desk as tall as the Empire State Building. Behind the desk sat a man wearing a name badge that was crooked but clearly read, Piggly Wiggly, manager, written largely underneath. He had black, heavy glasses and a white coat, and he leaned over and peered at me. He already knows I'm guilty. I was shaking, and the chocolate was dried on my hands and face. Evidence abounded. My mom explained everything, how I had taken the footballs, how I had thought they were free, and how I needed to learn a lesson. With my chin touching my chest and barely peeking at the scary, doctorly, butcherly-looking man, my mom said, "Now say you're sorry and it won't happen again," or something like that. I mumbled, "I'm sorry." Tears started streaming again, and the manager didn't say much. "Just don't let this happen again. And, you know, people go to jail for things like this." Now, my only point of reference at this time in my life was Elvis singing Jailhouse Rock. And that looked pretty fun, but I got it. I got the seriousness of it all by my mom's angry reaction and the solemn stare of the manager. We walked back over to Crystal's, and my mom ordered our food. I was grateful we were at a counter much more my size and that my pretty white rabbit fur coat was still white with no remnants of chocolate.
Melanie Baden is the director of the Museum of Arkansas Grand Prairie. She is the author of Skullgrass, a collection of poetry, and is a featured author in the anthology Poesia. She recently was published in the Smithsonian's Agricultural Innovation and Heritage Archive with her short story, God and the Farmer. She is also the proud mother of David, Morgan, and Jake, and one cat named Sunshine. Next, let's go to DeWitt Livestock Show and Rodeo with Deb Cantrell in My Last Beauty Pageant.
"Hit don't know, hit ain't pretty," I overhear my grandmother say to her sister. I'm crouched low behind the peony bush under the open window, playing hide and seek with my cousins. The frazzled feathered chickens are clucking and flapping their wings. I peep over the windowsill and see Meemaw and Great Aunt Darnell sitting at the kitchen table. They're stirring leftover cornbread into their buttermilk. I duck down quickly. "Well, Hit'll learn soon enough when Hit starts to school. Them spiteful young'uns will make fun of them big ears, bow legs, and bug eyes. She'll come home a-bawling like a fresh-weaned heifer," Aunt Darnella says, wiping her mouth on her apron. "Yep, you can mark it down. Sure as Moses parted the waters and them little Hebrew children walked across on dry land," Meemaw agrees. "She's gonna have to live with the fact all her natural life. That little gal is gonna have to find some real charm to overcome them plain looks the good Lord gave her. Maybe she'll up and turn out smart and everything will be okay. That's about the best we can hope for. Poor little thing. Please, sweet baby Jesus, I think, don't let them be talking about me. But I suspect they are. I even know what they're talking about and why. There has been a lot of whispering and quick smiles ever since we arrived for our holiday visit. Someone has told them that I have been recently disgraced. Over the past few months, the news has made its way from Arkansas to Tennessee. You see, last October, my mother entered me in the Little Miss DeWitt Beauty Pageant, an annual feature of the DeWitt Livestock Show in Rodeo. I wore a pale blue, iridescent, shiny, ruffled dress with big starched petticoat underneath that scratched my legs when I walked. The lace trim on my white socks matched the lace on my dress and seemed the ultimate fashion statement to me. I wore black patent shoes with tiny, hard-to-fasten buckles. My mother parted my thin blonde hair with a rat-tail comb and pulled the top back tight into a barrette with teeth that dug into my hair. She fluffed my bangs into curls over my eyes and poofed out the sides to cover my elephant ears, but the left one still poked out no matter what. I got to wear a pearl necklace and waxy lipstick, fashion pink. That was the only good part of the whole experience. When the master of ceremonies called my name, Deborah Nell O'Daniel, the microphone squawked like a squawking blue jay. I tiptoed out on the stage, holding my offended ears, in case it happened again. I saw the whole town congregated there in the giant auditorium of the old War Memorial Building. People had come from everywhere. Lodge's Corner, St. Charles, Biomeda, Point Deluce, Brewer Bottoms, and even Gillette to sit in those dingy, gray, metal folding chairs, all cold and uncomfortable, to just sit there and stare at us walk around. I wondered why people would do this. I carried a bouquet of daisies in one white-gloved hand and a cardboard pageant number the size of a notebook in the other. We all 14 paraded out together in a crooked line down the long runway protruding into the audience. Some of the girls wore bouncing ringlets, like Shirley Temple. A few sported carnation wrist corsages, and one had glitter on her shoes. All wore frozen smiles. Many were really scared and about to cry. I was not. I wasn't afraid one bit. I was in too much pain from the barrette digging in my scalp and the starched petticoat on my bare legs scratching. I thought if I walked on my tiptoes, that might help. I saw my mother waving her fist with her thumb pointed down over and over. She gave me a big frown and mouthed, "Walk right." I smiled my plaster smile, rolled my eyes at her, and kept on walking on my tiptoes. People laughed. The master of ceremonies, Mr. Patilla, boomed his radio voice into the screeching microphone. "Thank you, young ladies. Now please turn to your right." No one moved. We didn't know where our right was. People laughed more, and then he sang out, "Okay, girls, please turn toward the windows." Well, we did this with no problem. I saw one of the judges scribble a note and hand it to Mr. Patilla. He snickered.
"Number 9, he said, "the judges cannot see your number. Please turn it over."
I looked down at the number I carried facing the sash on my waist. Number 6. I wondered who he was talking to.
"Turn your number over, please, number 9, he said again.
Well, I turned my number upside down and I began to worry, because now it was a number 9.
"The judges can't see your number. Turn your number over and toward the judges, please, number 9.
I saw my mother making twirling motions with her arms over and over again. She looked mad and sad at the same time. Then Mr. Patillo, in his tuxedo with shiny shoes, stepped out behind the podium and walked out on the runway. He stopped in front of me and leaned over. I could smell the white gardenia in his lapel. He took the number card from my hand, and he turned it around so I couldn't see the number, but the people in the audience could. And they were all laughing loud. He smiled, and he patted me on the head, smashing those barrette teeth into my skull. So I stuck out my tongue and crossed my eyes. And the people laughed more. Mother was not laughing. She was fanning herself with the program and digging in her pocketbook for her scented handkerchief. My little brother was pointing his finger at me and giggling, rocking back and forth in his chair. My dad lit a cigarette. The rest of the contest was a blur. I did not win. I did not get a first, second, or third runner-up. I did not get an honorable mention. And I did not get to be in the Princess Court. I did not get to ride on the Princess Float in the Livestock Show Parade. I did not get a plastic tiara with rhinestones. After the pageant, Mother and Dad took us to the Burgermaster for chocolate milkshakes to celebrate. I'm not sure what we were celebrating. They never said anything about what happened. We never spoke a single word about that night. But I knew it did not go well. I thought maybe I lost the contest because of the tiptoeing and showing the backside of my number card to the judges. My first high society event and foray into public limelight was a night I was trying to forget. But the news traveled to Meemaw's house in Tennessee, and now I'm thinking that the hit don't know hit ain't pretty. Talk is more than likely about me. And I'm wondering where exactly a 5-year-old goes to find enough charm to get her through the rest of her life.
Deb Cantrell is an equine historian who lives in Nashville, Tennessee, where she practices law, lectures on ancient warfare, photographs zoo animals, travels to exotic places, and avoids beauty pageants. In our final story of the night, Candace Parker realizes a little too late that her decision was not such a good idea in No One Cries Pretty.
I never thought I would find myself ugly crying alone in a forest located in the Pacific Northwest. Then again, I never thought anyone would convince me to run a marathon either. Shockingly enough, these unexpected circumstances just so happened to fall on the same day. Before my story starts, let me just say that this is not a motivational sports analogy. This is a tale about the consequences of pulling an innocent Southern girl out of Cracker Barrel and placing her in a pair of running shoes in the state of Washington. Though I can easily pretend to belong anywhere, I know now there's a reason it's called Southern Comfort, as I've experienced firsthand the cultural divide of the United States of America. I've always enjoyed setting goals for myself. Generally, these goals include things like eating 3 slices of pizza instead of 2. Or perhaps challenging my car to go a little bit further than the week before with the gas light on. It wasn't until both of my older sisters were bragging about their victories in exercise that I realized I had nothing to contribute to the conversation. Being the youngest, I had my excuses for not exerting physical activity. Ever since I was a small babe, people found it adorable to carry me around like a little lap dog. Unfortunately, once I earned the right to vote, phrases like, "I'm still growing," and "pick me up," seemed to be a little bit weird and a little less relevant. That being said, I made up my mind one extremely optimistic day that I would run a marathon before I turned 20. It's probably worth noting that this notion came to me roughly 2 months prior to my 20th birthday. If you don't know much about training for a marathon, let me tell you that this isn't the smartest idea. With so little time to train, I would have been better off signing up for a little league camp where everybody wins, or maybe even a chess tournament. But as silly as it sounds, I bought a pair of Nikes and started setting my alarm on Saturday mornings. The next 2 months would include several hours of sweaty conversations by myself, followed by even more hours of cursing my own existence, as well as everybody else who found this an enjoyable activity. Regardless of the negativity and weird grunting, I improved enough to purchase a plane ticket to Seattle to run a race with my sister Kristen, who actually enjoyed this kind of thing and actually cared. I think it goes without saying that Seattle is a little bit different than Little Rock, Arkansas. I learned this when Kristen moved there a few years ago. I watched my sister trade in her cowboy boots for Birkenstocks and eventually, dare I even say it, become a vegan. Maybe I'm a little too young to relate to these cold details, but I do know a thing or two about Southern charm. I entered this uncharted territory with phrases like, my pleasure, and thank you kindly, taking on the persona of a Chick-fil-A employee, or maybe a golden retriever that really just wanted a belly rub. I left Little Rock Airport with a confidence that only comes with oblivion. The Pacific Northwest is undoubtedly gorgeous. The scenery is breathtaking and the people stroll about with a mysterious attractiveness that has to be the result of a healthy digestive system and daily organic skin regimen. I walked around an unashamed tourist and found any excuse to explain to strangers why my reasons for being in the area, as if I ran marathons all of the time and as if they actually cared. The morning of the marathon, I woke up alert, like Lassie had just notified me that little Timmy was stuck in the well. With sporadic nerves, I got dressed, applied my deodorant, and my handy Crisco stick that was supposed to prevent chafe. My sister excitedly drove me to the course, asking me to describe my feelings spiritually and to let nature calm me, while I quietly ate my feelings in the passenger seat. It turns out Seattle runners are an entirely different breed of humans. With skinny collarbones and legs like horses, I couldn't help but think they looked like triangle pizza slices. As if it weren't obvious, I had several people notify the crowd that this was in fact my first marathon. Are you nervous? They would ask. It never really occurred to me what to be nervous about, but now that I stood here in the woods like fresh meat, I wondered if this was one of those drink the Kool-Aid scenarios and maybe I'd misread the email. 5 minutes before the race began, an announcer explained the course. We would run 26.2 miles up a mountain, and that's what I had to be nervous about. While other brothers were deciding their goals for finishing, I was wondering whether I should tell my parents I loved them and that it was actually me who drank the last beer Christmas 2009. The first few miles were positive. I've been more successful than all-you-can-eat pancake day at IHOP, but this wasn't going too bad either. Hours passed, and to my surprise, this was going to take a little bit longer than an ordinary fun run. It was actually going to take 7 hours. While most of it is a blur now, I do remember the ugly crying. I remember eating snacks that looked more like science experiments than food, and I recall all the words my grandma would slap me for saying out loud. I remember the sweet tea that does not exist in this part of the country. I'm not entirely sure at what point I considered calling a hotline, but I do know there wasn't a payphone nearby. After a strong pull-yourself-together moment, I hobbled to the finish line as chariots of fire played in my head. I fell to the ground in my final breath before standing up. I whispered, "Let's go get biscuits." If you're thinking this sounds dramatic, it's because it was. Regardless, victory was mine, and it wasn't because of anything northern-related. I left that side of the country with an overwhelming appreciation for the laid-back kindness that is so unique to my southern ground. There are a few mountain ranges between here and the west, and I'm assuming create such a cultural disconnect. There's something to be appreciated about all regions of this beautiful country, and I hope to have the opportunity to see them all. But that said, I will never again to attempt to sweat out the South.
Candace Parker is a student and graphic designer based in Little Rock, Arkansas. This is her second story to read on Tales from the South. When she's not busy writing or working, Candace enjoys hiking, traveling, and listening to you talk about your favorite things. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers' Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
All right, here's a new one for you.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.